Okay, so here we are. So, like I was saying, we're here on page 362 in the Art Scroll Chumash. Okay, so a few mitzvot are kind of interspersed and mixed up here. So we've discussed the mitzvah of the Karban Pesach, and we discussed the mitzvah of the Bechor, of the firstborn, and now we're going to talk about the mitzvah of Tefillin. So like we do, we're going to first go through what the Chumash says, and then analyze it, and then take it from there into the meaning of the mitzvah and what it's about. Like many of the other mitzvot, especially Tefillin, this is one of a few times that the Torah mentions Tefillin. We'll have to see one or two others just to get a bit of a broader perspective, because not everything is here. But we'll get the point from the outset. Okay, so we start off page 362. We're in Perek Yud Gimel in Shemot. We'll start with Pasuk Tet, verse 9. So we'll do it in Hebrew, then in English. Ve'ayalecha li'ot ayatcha l'zikaron bein einecha. Leman tiyeh Torat ad Hashem beficha, ki biyad chazaka hotziacha Hashem mimitzrayim. V'shemata techukah azot lemoada miyamim yamima. And it shall be for you a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes, so that Hashem's Torah may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand Hashem removed you from Egypt. You shall observe this decree at its designated time from year to year. Okay, and now we turn the page. And now we look at the last pasuk of the entire parsha. Ve'ayah le'ot al yadcha u'letot afot bein enecha ki b'chozeg yad hotzianu Hashem mimitzrayim. And shall be a sign upon your arm and an ornament between your eyes, for with a strong hand Hashem removed us from Egypt. Okay? So a mitzvah so nice they said it twice. Back to back. Okay? Right? So we said it first here in verses 9 and 10, and then in verse 16. So let's see the similarities and the differences between just these two. Okay, so let's start off and says, Ve'alcha li'ot ayatcha l'zikaron bein einecha. Okay, so it shall be a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes. Okay, what does that mean?
That it will be a symbol that you have on your arm.
Okay, so a symbol, a sign on your arm. A symbol of what?
I don't know. Because then he says, so that Hashem's Torah may be in your mouth. So, like, all of those things lead up to the Torah. So, from what I understand, he's saying, like, it'll be a sign on your arm, a reminder between your eyes, so okay, that you can basically talk about Hashem's Torah.
Okay, so the sign on your arm and the remembrance between your eyes so that you remember the Torah. So the way you understand it? Yeah? Okay. Ki biyach chazka tzeicha Hashem Mitzrayim, for with a strong hand Hashem removed you from Egypt. So what does that second part have to do with it? So that's a little... Now we get a second message, right? So we have two messages here delivered when it comes to Tefillin. Number one message is that we shall remember the Torah. The Torah shall be present in our mouths. And the second one is that we remember the Exodus from Egypt. And in the process here, we have a sign and a remembrance. Okay, a sign and a remembrance, which are similar kind of things, but what distinguishes one from the next? Okay. What else do we have to understand from this verse? What else requires more understanding?
I think it's unclear what... Like, the sign on your arm, that's kind of symbolic. But, like, a reminder between your eyes.
Okay.
I think that's a very kind of vague...
Well, even the first one, right? I mean, the most basic question is, what kind of sign? What kind of sign on your arm? A tattoo? A picture? A certain kind of clothing.
The it is not defined.
A what?
The it is not defined.
Right. The most important thing is not defined. I'm sorry?
A bracelet, right.
Your arm, where my arm? Well, yeah, I mean, yad typically means your hand, right? Now, it's used as arm as well, but if you wanted it, you could just as easily read it as hand than arm. So what's on your hand, then that can mean even more things. It could be a ring. It could be, I don't know, I mean, you can come up with a million examples. Okay, so we have an ambiguous sign, and just to make it more ambiguous, we have ulazikaron. We have a reminder, which isn't even physical, necessarily. So now we have an ambiguous sign and an unclear reminder, okay? To remember what? So that Hashem's Torah should be in your mouth, okay? So now we basically have a mitzvah that we don't know what we're supposed to do. We don't know how we're supposed to do it. And in some way, that's supposed to help us remember the Torah or keep it in our mouths. Okay, that's what we've got so far. Right? Okay. And at the same time, oh yeah, by the way, remember that God took you out with a strong hand from Egypt. While you're looking at the ambiguous sign, do that as well. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, you know, maybe if someone's creative, they can come up with some sort of picture that's going to combine the two themes. You know, there's a lot of ways, you know, people could do it. But that's all we got. Okay. And then the second time around, on the next page, how is it different? How is it similar?
As an ornament between your eyes, as opposed to a remember.
Okay, so now we have the word totafot, which in English here is ornament, as opposed to reminder. So, seems to be a little bit more tangible, although the term totafot is pretty vague in itself. It's not really a word we see elsewhere. And the commentaries have to figure out, you know, the Talmud has to figure out what this word even means. But okay, we'll come to an understanding of what it means and what the understanding is. But so now we have a new word, and then what's the reason for tefillin here? It's only the Egypt, right? It's only because of remembering Egypt. We don't have any mention here of the Torah. The second time around, there's nothing with the Torah. Let's go to another instance where we see it, just to get the little fuller picture. Okay. So let's turn to Dvarim Yud Aleph, Deuteronomy 11. Okay, we're on page 995. Okay, so here we have the second paragraph of the Shema. In the second paragraph of the Shema, starting with verse 13, and it will be that if you hearken to my commandments, they command you today to love Hashem, your God, and to serve Him with all your heart, with all your soul, then I shall provide rain for your land in its proper time, the early and the late rains, that you may gather in your grain, your wine, and your oil. I shall provide grass in your fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Beware for yourselves, lest your heart be seduced, and you turn astray and serve gods of others, and prostrate yourselves to them. Then the wrath of Hashem will blaze against you. He will restrain the heavens, so there will be no rain, and the ground will not yield its produce, and you will be swiftly banished from the goodly land that Hashem gives you. You shall place these words of mine upon your heart and upon your soul, and you shall bind them for a sign upon your arm, and they shall be, and let them be an ornament between your eyes. In Hebrew, v'samtem et ra'ei al avavchem v'al nafshechem. Right? So now we have a mention here of it being on your heart and on your soul. That's a new concept. We didn't know about the soul before. That wasn't part of the mix. Ukshartem otam li'ot ayetchem. And now we're tying them. Right? Before we just said...
Just a sign.
Just it shall be a sign on your arm. We didn't have any verb on how we're doing it. So now we're tying it. Okay, so now we have somewhat of a picture. We're tying something. Okay, it could be a bandana, but at least we have a little bit of a picture here. So now we're tying this. Liot ayetchem v'ayul tatafo be'enechem, and that's like we said before, also shall be an ornament between your eyes. Okay, so, and there's a few other examples, but this, between the two of them, we get the majority of what the picture of this mitzvah is about. Okay.
This also says what the sign, what it says... shall place these words.
Right, now there's words. Ah, good point. Okay, so now we have, so there's words, there's tying. Right, we've got a little more going on. Right, okay, fine. And now we have nefesh, we have soul. And here we don't have a reason necessarily. Now it's tied into the next mitzvah. The next mitzvah seems to be connected, right? And it's l'matem matem b'neichem. So now we're teaching your children, discuss the Torah when you awake and you arise. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. So now we have some other mitzvah that it's connected to. It seems it's put in tandem with the mitzvah that earlier in Shemot, we don't have that.
But are they the same word? Because like, if you read this, it seems like they're almost like the same words. Like the same words, you have to bind them to yourself, like teach them to your kids, but like...
Yeah.
Is it all the same words? Or is the words being generalized for... words of the Torah.
Because it says ukshatim otam, you should tie them, and it says, and you should learn them. Right. It's pretty vague. Yeah, that's true. It seems to be connected. Maybe it's the same words, maybe it's a part of it. Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, it's clear that it seems that they're connected. Okay. So, now, remember we've talked about the context of the mitzvah, and here we're finishing up in these mitzvot that are given to the Jewish people before Mount Sinai. Right? And that's kind of has a special element to itself. It's in and of itself. These are the special mitzvot that they're receiving before the people receive the Torah at Mount Sinai as a whole. So that in some ways this is supposed to prepare them for their journey and send a message as they're leaving Egypt. Remember, this is as they're leaving Egypt, they're getting these mitzvot. So this becomes an integral mitzvah, right? And the truth is we saw the mitzvot that were chosen here, the Karban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, the firstborn mitzvah, this mitzvah, it doesn't seem to be the integral mitzvah of Judaism necessarily. And yet, these are the ones that are chosen, so they're clearly very closely connected to what's happening here and the message that they're supposed to be receiving. So, all right, so let's get into this a little bit. Yeah, sure.
It says, you shall observe this decree at its designated time from year to year.
Where are you? Which verse?
Verse 10.
Yeah.
The verse you stopped and didn't read. So it implies here that you don't do it all the time. Whereas in Deuteronomy, it sort of implies that you should.
No. Well, that's the...
Yeah. I mean, here, Rashi, it's from year to year. It means it's forever. It means it's permanent. That's the way Rashi reads it. I'm not sure the English translation probably doesn't imply that as much, but yeah, it seems to be this is from year to year, generation to generation. It's not temporary.
It's continuously.
Yeah. Right, it's continuously, which is an interesting thing of itself. I guess that's more needed here because this is before the Jews have received the Torah, so they need to know this is permanent. God's not just telling them to do something in preparation of going to Mount Sinai. This is a part of the whole process. Okay. So I'm going to start with the perspective of Rav Shimshon Mefrul Hirsch, who gave a very nice broad overview of what this mitzvah is about, and then we're going to use some other commentaries to deal with some of the specifics. But he gives a very nice perspective on it. Okay, so let's start with body parts. What body parts are we dealing with here? Are we putting stuff on? Are we connected to? Let's list them.
A hand or an arm.
Okay, so we have hand, arm. Okay. What else?
Eyes.
We have eyes.
Or forehead. Between the eyes.
Between the eyes, okay.
It could be nose also.
Okay. Okay, what else?
The heart.
Okay, so we saw the heart.
Oh, that's more like in a symbolic sense rather than a literal sense.
Is what?
The heart. It talks about the heart.
We'll see. We'll see if it's somewhat symbolic, but we'll see that there's some literal aspect to that as well.
Also upon your soul.
Okay, so we saw the soul, right? Which is kind of a body part. Anything else?
She said mouth.
Okay. Oh, it should be on your mouth, right?
Okay.
Right. The Torah should be right, which is an interesting way of saying it, instead of just saying so you can learn it, so you can remember it, that it should be present on your mouth, which imply, what does that imply? It's present on your mouth.
You're speaking.
Right, that it's on the tip of your tongue, right? That's a good phrase. It's on the tip of your tongue. It's something that, it's not just something you know about, it's something that you're engaged in, right, on a regular basis. So you're really involved. Okay. So, let's do a little tutorial here. So, here we have tefillin. And I'm going to show it to you because it's very integral to understand, according to Rav Shimshon Frohl Hirsch, what this is about. So we have two different types of tefillin. We have the head tefillin, and we have the arm tefillin. Now, we'll get to a little bit later how this comes to look like this. So we have two different boxes, okay? And everyone can pass this around. They can see it, they can touch and feel it. These are mine. I bought them in Israel 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. So, okay, we have the head tefillin and the arm tefillin. Now, we see the concept of tying here because it ends up being tied to your body. And the idea of the words being written, so here we have parchment inside, okay? Now, there's two different ways that the parchment is done. In the head tefillin, there's four different compartments, okay? And it's opened up here, it's tied in. Four different compartments where the four different parsho, the four different places where the Torah discusses tefillin, they're placed on separate areas in four different parchments, okay? In seven little different chambers. And the arm tefillin, they're put, it's all in one parchment and all just in one chamber. Okay, so that's number one. So, I'll wear it. I feel like I'm modeling or something, but all right. There's a point to it. Okay, so the point is, you start it between your eyes. Okay, so you put the tefillin on your head between your eyes, and then you take the two leather straps and put them down. Okay, like that. So, what Shimshon Rav Hirsch is explaining is that the purpose of tefillin, and this is a pretty central theme to it, is that we're trying to connect all the different parts of our body, okay, into one common theme, one common purpose, okay? And we're going to be taking the hand and the arm, the eyes, the heart, and then with the eyes we're going to have to get into the head, because that ends up being what it's about. Instead of putting it in between your eyes, you're putting it on your head, but stationed between your eyes. And all of these things kind of come into one. So basically, these three things come into one. So the way he explains it is that, let's say how do people experience something? So what's the first part of your body that typically experiences something?
The eyes.
The eyes, right? Mm-hmm. The first thing that we experience is through our eyes. So where does it go from our eyes?
To the brain.
Okay, so it goes from our eyes into the head. Okay, everyone's with me still? Okay.
Unless it's dark.
What?
Unless it's dark.
It still goes to the brain.
Right, okay. I mean, obviously there's sound and there's smell and there's other senses. But typically the way we experience something is through our eyes. Which is why, if you go back to where we were a little bit before, that's why the third paragraph of Shema discusses... The third paragraph of Shema says that you have to be careful with what you see, right? The essence of you're affected by what you see, that's the beginning of your experience, okay? So if the beginning of your experience is through your eyes and then it goes into your head, so that's why instead of just saying that the tefillin should be placed on top of your head, it has to be between your eyes because the eyes are an integral component of what this is about, okay? So, if it's seen through the eyes and it goes into the head, that's how the message begins, okay? Now, what happens when it gets to your head is a very interesting discussion, okay? Because all of our faculties are interrelated. So, let's say we break it up into three different things, okay? And that's what we see over and over again in the commentaries. That we break up our decision-making processes into our brain, our action, and our emotion. Now...
Not always in this order.
No, in no particular order. In no particular order. But there is no order here. And I think that's why it's important. Is that I was seeing some commentaries that are explaining that we need the brain to overcome the emotion, and that will lead to action. Right? That's the idea. That it goes from the brain And that trumps the emotion to the action. But it's not true, because it's not that simple. They're all interconnected, and there are times when the brain is legislating the emotion which leads to the action. There are times when the emotion is legislating the brain. They're all interconnected. So, for example, let's take Tiger Woods.
Ah.
Okay? So if you listen to the voice message today, right? Today, who heard the voice mail today?
I read it.
You read it? Oh, you got to hear it.
I heard it.
Neil even heard it. What? You didn't hear the voice mail?
Even Neil. I heard it.
So you didn't, you know. You're not the internet pro.
It didn't make any sense. What was he talking about?
Who needs the internet? You got the news.
Oh, okay. You want to know what? Okay, this is what it is. He's leaving a message to this woman, who's not his wife, basically asking her, saying, my wife is going through my cell phone, and she saw your number, expect a call from her, and could you just do me this one favor? You know, when you leave on your voicemail, you leave your name, so when someone calls, right, they hear, you know, you reached, and then you hear your name and your voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he asked her to change the setting so that instead of hearing, you have called, you know, Rachel Johnson, instead you just hear, you've called, you know how you get the, in systems, it's the number, mm-hmm. you've reached, and then you're not sure if you dialed the right number, like, oh wait, mm-hmm. because it's too confusing. So he asked her to change her name to the number, so when the wife called, she wouldn't know who she was calling, so she wouldn't get busted. That's the essence with the, and then he's like, please do this, please, 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 I'm begging you. Right, that's the voicemail message that the mistress saves, then sells to Us Magazine for $150,000, along with 300 text messages that received from him, and now we have a international story. So, what did he do? Let's take Tiger Woods. What did he do? So when he was calling the alleged mistress and asking her to change the voicemail message, so which part of his, which faculty was he using?
Not the brain.
Well, I disagree.
He was using the brain.
That's exactly what he was using, right?
Telling her to change the setting.
Right. So he knows he's in trouble. He knows he's busted, and now he's got to figure out how to get out of it, right? How to avoid it. So he's completely using his brain, right?
Very on a very limited scale.
Well, I'm saying he's trying to figure out what to do, right? How to handle the situation. Now, he didn't get into this mess because of his brain, right? Not at all, right? This wasn't part of the equation when he got into this trouble. But to get out of the trouble, now he needs his brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So very often in life, the brain can become, you know, the ultimate tool for destruction, right? It can also be the tool ultimately used for self-improvement. But when the brain is used, you could say it's, you know, it's used by the emotion, but manipulation, lying, trying to figure out how to get what you want and get away with it, right? Your brain can be used in a number of ways that it really is trumping the rest of them. It's acting under the guise of the brain, but it's really following orders based on where I'm trying to get this, so now I need my brain to figure out how to do it. And then once I figure out how to do it, now the brain can go away, right? So once I figure out how to be the mistress, so then the brain can check out, and then I'll call him back when I need him again. So that's what ends up happening. So the brain ends up becoming the most powerful tool that we have, but it all depends on how it's used and what we do with it. And obviously the brain is connected to the eyes. That's where the message comes in first. Okay. So the way Rav Shemshul Hirsch is writing is that we process things, you know, through the brain, and it goes through the brain, then it goes down into the emotion, and then it goes into the action. And the ultimate question becomes, like, who's bossing around to? Right? Who's bossing around to? So if the emotion's bossing around the brain, then the brain is the ultimate tool, right, to get what it wants, right? If the brain is bossing around the action, then the action will, you know, then your body will do what it what you think it should be doing. And, you know, but ultimately they're all interconnected in a very complicated way. So you can't just quote-unquote sanctify or make one of these things your tool for connecting with God. Meaning, if your religious experience is just an emotional one, it's not going to last very long. It's not going to have much meaning. Okay? I'll tell you this example. One time I was in when I was in NASA in Houston. When I was in Houston, I taught a class at the NASA Johnson Space Center. Okay, so we taught. I had like twice a month. I drive down there. It's like a 45-minute drive from Houston, in the middle of nowhere. And I teach a class to the Jewish, you know, scientists who work at the NASA Space Center. So they had like this, I don't know, this building that had like a gym, and it had a workout room, and then they had all these classrooms for different things that were going on. So, you know, we'd be in a room, it's always a different room, we'd have a lunch, and we, you know, whatever topics we wanted to discuss. So we discussed some very interesting things. You know, the biggest class, the most well-attended class by far was, when Mel Gibson's movie came out, what was it called? The Passion of the Christ. When that came out and I did a response to The Passion of the Christ, suddenly like all the Jews came out of the woodwork. Like, we get usually 8 or 9. There were like 30 people there for that class. It was unbelievable. I guess in the middle of Texas you get So one time our class was right next to this like Christian revival group, right? And it's also that's for their class, right? And I'm walking by the group, walking to our class, and our class was very intellectual. You can imagine these are physicists and scientists. You know, I mean, it was a very intellectual, very high level discussion. So we walk by the room, and I just pause for a second, and they're playing guitar, and they're all like have their eyes closed, and they're all like going like this, and like you know, and like it was like very like it was like you know. And I don't know how to describe it. You can know picture I'm talking about. It was like a revival meeting. And I sit there and I stop for like 3 seconds. And I walk into my room and I said, I can't believe how different our class is than theirs. You know, like the Jewish class is here and the Christian class is there. And they couldn't be more different, right? Now, I'm not saying... Now, obviously, you need both. If you have only an intellectual connection to religion, it's also going to be very lacking. And I've known many people who had a very... intellectual approach, but if it wasn't really backed up with an emotional connection to God, it's hard for it to last. It becomes grinding, it becomes difficult, it becomes challenging, and there's not a real wellspring of support behind it. But if you only have the emotion, and it's not really intellectual in any level, it's a purely faith, emotion, religion, then just as much, it's going to be so severely lacking that it's going to lack any meaning at a certain point. Just last week, I was talking to this woman who grew up Catholic, and she was asking if I took the Torah literally, right? She said, do you take the Torah literally, or do you like use it as like a basis to understand kind of big picture, broad, you know, be nice to each other, and give charity, and don't kill your neighbor, you know, all these good things to know, right? Don't commit adultery. I'm tying Tiger Woods in every single thing. So what I said to her was, I do take it literally. I said, the reason you probably don't take it so literally is because you never really looked at the Torah as a sophisticated book. If you just look at it as a very basic understanding of life, or some primitive concepts that led to more sophisticated concepts as we know them today, so then you don't really have any intellectual capacity to understand Judaism, because... it's not meaningful to you. It doesn't speak to you. It's not in your world. And if the Torah is not in your world, then it's going to lack meaning. It's not going to be that meaningful. So in order for it to work, you need emotion. It needs to be intellectually satisfying. It has to connect to the world that you understand. You know, and so often I feel like religion becomes an escape, but it's not really reality. It doesn't really deal with the things that we actually think about and talk about. So it has to be able to be that as well. And it has to be action. All of that is well and good, but if it doesn't in any way come out in how you live your life, then as well it's not going to go very far. So you can debate the interrelation of the three, which one has to come first, which one doesn't have to come first. And we'll discuss that in a second. But they're all interconnected. So it goes in through the brain, and then... the way he describes it, I thought this was interesting, was, it goes in through the brain, then it goes down, these are called the Betsuo, it goes down the straps, right? Why do we have these long straps, right? They're not tied to anything, they just hang. So he writes, the idea is it goes into your eyes, between your eyes, into your brain, and then goes down over your heart, right? And this is going over your heart. So it connects to your heart, okay? And then it transfers. You know, it's like this kind of like this stream of energy, you could look at it. Right? And then this goes onto your arm when it's facing your heart. So it goes from here to here. They're almost touching very often there. You've almost connected. So it goes down through here, then into your arm, which is your action. So it's flowing from your eyesight into your brain, through the emotion, and into your action. Okay?
But it's on your left hand and your right hand.
Ah, we'll get to why it's on the left hand. I saw a beautiful kliyukr, why it's on your left hand. It's a good question. I thought it was great. I'll show you. It's really good.
It's the weaker hand.
Why is it on your weaker hand? It should be in your stronger hand. I have a good answer for it. Yeah.
It's closer to your heart.
Mm-hmm. So that's one answer, is that it's closer to your heart. Then your left side is closer to your heart, so it's connected. But you can also do it other ways. But you're right. That is part of it. That's closer to your heart. But I saw something to add to it.
But it's the weaker hand.
What?
Person who's left-handed will turn to his right.
We don't take lefties seriously. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, they're not.
We don't take lefties seriously.
Oh, God. You always got to get one line in every class, right? Mm-hmm. Lefties. I mean, it's an interesting question. Why do we even have stronger arms? Like, why are everyone's both arms the same strength? It's an interesting question. I don't know.
Because we use one that. More.
No, but we're naturally inclined to use one over the other. I mean, you could be trained to use the other one if as a child you're doing it. Again, baseball, you have like guys who like throw with their right hand and hit with their left hand. Or there's different skills.
It's because the right represents chesed and the left represents gvura.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying there's certain symbolism to why we have a strong versus a weak. And yeah, so we'll talk about it. Okay. So that's what he's trying to say. So the idea is that we're going to, that we want to channel things through our brain. That we want as much as possible that our brain is the one making the decisions versus our actions and emotion, and then our brain only becomes subservient to them. So if the first line of defense, if it's going through the brain, so we have to make sure that that's ultimately how we want it to work. So we want to emphasize the brain, connect it to the emotion, and then connect it to action as well. But it's interesting because it works in both ways. So which of the two do we put on first? Do we put on the arm to fill in first or the head to fill in first?
The head.
We put on the head, the hand, the arm first. Yeah. So why is that? If we're going to say that the whole purpose is we want the brain to be the focus, so then the first one we should put on is the head and then the arm. So why do we put the arm on before the head? So this is what he writes. He writes, because it's supposed to represent the concept of Na'aseh V'Nishma, right? That the Jewish people, when they receive the Torah, God says, do you want the Torah? They say, we will do and we will hear. Na'aseh V'Nishma. They commit to doing the Torah before they even know what it is, right? So that's really what we're doing, is we're showing our commitment to the Torah. We're putting on the arm. We're ready to do it before we've even grasped what we're doing. So that ultimately as well, when it comes to practicing Judaism and really connecting with it, so it has to be more than just, we'll think about it, and if we like it, we'll do it, maybe on some way, ultimately we'll find a way to incorporate it into our lives. But we have to start with a basic level of commitment, right? Like anything in life, right? If you want to start, you know, exercising, right? So if you're going to wait until every part of your body and mind and soul is ready to embrace exercising, right? Like, you'll never do it, right? You have to say, I'm committed to doing this every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, every Tuesday and Thursday at 8 o'clock, and I'm going to drag myself because I know that's my commitment. And then once you start doing it, when you're pulling yourself to do it, you're not like, you're kind of dragging. But then after you've done it, what does everybody say? Oh, I'm so glad I did that. I'm so glad I forced myself to do it, right? But that's what it feels like. You have to force yourself to do it. It starts with a commitment. And then when you live up to the commitment, you know that your heart and mind will follow as long as you know that your commitment is a sincere commitment. You know it's what you should be doing. So you have to really, you know, build it in. So it starts with the commitment that you have to get this done, and then the action will pull the rest together. So you have to be ready to commit to the action for all of this to work, right? But if there's no action or no commitment to action, then the brain and the emotion are going to have a very hard time making this work in this world, okay? Any questions then on this? Okay. Now, that's where the soul comes in as well. So we talked about the eyes, which goes into the head. We talked about the heart, which is somewhat figurative, but we really try to make kind of a physical manifestation of the heart. It goes through the straps into the heart, and then the tefillin, the arm, is facing the heart. So we take it literally in some level as well. We have the arm, which shows action, and the soul is supposed to combine all of them together, right? The soul is what makes all of it work. And the tefillin is interesting because when we talked about a sign versus or a remembrance, so it seemed like we're talking about things that were very ephemeral, right? They were, you know, not really grounded so much. There were concepts, there were remembrance, something to assign. These are things that are very vague. And we end up with something very physical, right? This is very physical. It's almost rough. It's hard. It's solid. It's made of leather, you know? I mean, you can't get more physical than this. So it really is representing the coming together of body and soul. I mean, that's what a lot of this is. You have inside this very physical thing, the words of the Torah, hidden inside, can't see it, right? For all, I can show you, it could be Bazooka Comics in there, right? It could be, you know, Tiger Woods scorecard from the Masters in 1998. It could be anything, right? The idea is you have hidden inside the physical, the spiritual. It's supposed to really represent our souls. The tefillin, in that sense, represents our souls. Hidden inside our very physical bodies is the most purely spiritual being that we can't see, feel, and touch. But without the soul, this is meaningless. This is just a box. Without the Torah inside, it's just a box. What makes it the whole thing relevant is the spiritual capacity hidden inside of it. And that's the way we are as well.
There's one letter on the outside, though.
That's symbolic. Yeah. No, it is. You're right.
Shin, but one shin has four, like, parts, and one has three.
That's true. I don't have a good explanation offhand.
Well, the four could be just because it has four compartments.
The four compartments.
And that could be. Shin from that.
Well, that's a shin. Well, we have a shin because then we have a dalet and a yud as well. So if you see, sorry. So here, when the straps come together, it gets the shape of a dalet. And then when you do the hands, it's the shape of a yud. But it spells out one of Hashem's name, shin dal yud. So it's all come together for Hashem. So yeah, but that's like, that's part of the physical capacity, is we're bringing this together, you know, to bring Hashem into every part of ourselves. Okay. So what is this a sign of? So let's just get to a few more things. To make sure we cover everything. So there's an interesting disagreement or discussion between the Sefer Achinuch and the Ramban as to what's the tefillin is supposed to represent. When we say it's a sign and a remembrance, so what is it a sign of? So the Sefer Achinuch, we've used it a couple times when he gives explanations on the mitzvot. So he says here, the English translation, have man, a man in virtue of his temporal substance must, his temporal substance must needs be drawn to lust. That's not a really great line. For it is in the nature of the flesh to seek that which is pleasant, blindly like a horse or a mule, where not for the fact that the soul graciously implanted in him by God keeps him back as far as its power permits from sin. Since the soul dwells within the confines of the flesh, which is on earth and is far removed from its own natural frontier, which is in heaven, it cannot always muster sufficient strength to maintain its supremacy. Consequently, it requires many guardians to preserve it from its evil bedfellow, lest the latter rise up against it and slay it, whilst it remains within its jurisdiction and power. Very poetic here. The Holy One, blessed be He, wished therefore to confer on us, the holy people, opportunity for gaining merit, posting valiant watchmen around us. We have been commanded therefore not to interrupt our constant meditation on the words of the Torah, by day and by night, to place four fringes on the corners of our garments, and a mezuzah on our doorposts, and tefillin on our arm and our head. So that's what he's saying, that this is part of a system of mitzvot that we have to keep us in check. Okay? So we have tefillin, we have tzitzit, and we have the mezuzah. Why are two of those three things more things that males use as opposed to females? because men need to be kept in check more than women, as we saw with Tiger Woods. but basically the...
But if it wasn't for the woman, he wouldn't have done an
exception. What? You take exception?
Well, I mean, so Tiger Woods...
I don't think it's just Tiger Woods. I think this is a pretty constant... As I saw today, one of the top 10... I don't know what the word is. Tweets or word... when you put the...
The hash?
Yeah, the hash. I don't know what that word that you hash. I don't know what that's called. There's a
trending
word for it.
Trending topics.
Trending topics. Very good. Well, the top 10 trending topics today was why men cheat. That was a whole discussion. A whole thing of discussion.
You can pick any topic you wish.
What?
You can pick the same topic.
No, but I'm saying that the concept of men being aggressive, cheating, lusting. You think it's a myth?
Well, I mean, it's...
It's a pretty well-established myth.
Examples.
What? I'm not saying it's not that women don't sin. Not at all. I'm
just
saying
as many examples on each side.
Well, I think
no.
So I think what Robert Schuller, I guess, is trying to say, at least how I interpret it, is that maybe women, like this whole battle between the soul and your animal self, I guess, is the way to put it.
Okay.
That's amazing. I think like women, because they bring. Like life, and also like I think it's been alluded to other places in the Torah, like have more of that spirit, like that soulful spirituality. That's why they have to do like often even.
No, I mean women are more naturally reserved and kept in check, and men are more. You know, I mean, it's not a hard and fast rule. It's not that things, but men are more in need of control and discipline, right? You go into an army, right? I mean, that's the whole point is we're going to teach discipline to these young men because by definition, they're not going to have it on their own. You know, my wife teaches middle school. Anyone who works with kids, especially middle school, teenage kids, you look at a boy's notebook, you look at the girl's notebooks, right? You know, and every girl's taking copious notes and they're organized and they're all put together in their study groups and the boys are just like... You know, oh yeah, where's my notebook again? And like, you know, there are exceptions to these rules, but my wife teaches these kids. These boys are like in outer space until they're maybe 15 or 16. That they seem to be grounded in this world in some meaningful way. They're just in a different planet, and it takes a lot. They're just not in the same world, and that's just the way. That's the way the world is.
And also, when the Torah was given. I think Moshe was told to speak very strict to the men to prepare them for receiving the Torah, and to the women not so strict.
Right, exactly, for sure. Well, men are need and you can be more direct.
That's for a different reason.
Well, that's because you can be more direct with men. With women, you have to be more careful how you speak.
It might fall apart.
When was the Torah given?
The Torah was given in its entirety?
2448.
We want the exact year?
2448.
No, when in the course of the story?
Oh, so that's what we're saying. I mean, they received the Torah, quote-unquote, at Mount Sinai, but we're seeing here that they're getting snippets. They're getting bits and pieces in advance. Yeah. Yeah, they're getting bits and pieces in advance. Well, every mitzvah we've discussed so far is pre-Mount Sinai. Right? This is God talking to them pre-Mount Sinai. And then they get
this. I was wondering if this was the first reference to the Torah.
But I guess related to the point.
Yeah, it probably is, yeah.
So when they got the Torah, it was all written down. So it was all written down already, what had started happening. So like God is telling them all of this before He's giving them the Torah, but in the Torah it's already written all the stuff He's been.
Well, Moshe writes the Torah down, so God dictates and Moshe writes it down. So it's not written. It's I mean God knows what's going to be in the Torah, but it's not written yet. It's written over the 40 years that they're in the desert. Because they're writing stories as they're happening, many of which haven't happened yet. But also, I wanted to point this out as well, is that tefillin becomes a big sticking point in what becomes a big debate later in history, and that is the concept of the oral tradition. That the Sadducees versus the Pharisees, right? And the Prushim versus the Tzedukim. The Prushim believe strongly, and that's what we follow and establish today, that the Torah was given along with an oral tradition that teaches us how to understand many mitzvot. So tefillin is seen as one of the best examples of that, is because ultimately we have some, you know, clues as to what tefillin should be and look like, but still there's no way we come up with black boxes, right, with leather straps. So the understanding is that God tells Moses what they should look like, and also tells Moses, but don't write this down. I want this passed down from one generation to the next. It's part of the oral tradition, which becomes integral to Jewish writing, to Jewish learning, and the oral tradition doesn't get written down for thousands of years. It only gets written down when they're afraid they're going to lose it. At different points in Jewish history, there have been groups of Jews who wanted to take the Torah only literally and wanted to discount the concept of an oral tradition, and tefillin becomes a big sticking point, because if you don't have the oral tradition, you really could find any sort of sign between your eyes and a remembrance between your eyes and a sign on your hand, and it could look like a number of different things. So a lot of the commentaries here definitely use this as a point to discuss how important this mitzvah is to the oral tradition.
We don't take tefillin completely seriously all the time either, because on Shabbos, for example, the oats is Shabbos itself. It's not the tefillin, so you don't wrap tefillin.
It's not that we don't take it seriously.
It's not serious. It's literally right. So,
well, the oat is being accomplished elsewhere.
Right. The oat can be something else. It can be an idea. It can be a time. It doesn't have to be an actual.
Right. I mean the idea that this is safeguarding. Well, so it depends what the oat is. That could segue back to what we're talking about. So according to the Sefer HaChinuch, the oath is to remind us of the Torah, to keep it on our mouths, right? It's keep it prevalent. So the oath there on Shabbos is, all of Shabbos is doing that. We don't need to fill it anymore. It's overkill. It's unnecessary. We already have Shabbos to be involved into, you know, the Torah should be prevalent in our hearts and our minds. According to the Ramban, Nachmanides, the purpose of the mitzvah is to remind us of the miracle of leaving Egypt, and that we saw these two points are discussed, as we saw from the beginning, and that makes sense in this context, especially where they're leaving Egypt and they're figuring out how are we going to remember this, how are we going to commemorate this, how is this going to remain clear in our minds. So he writes, the Ramban writes that, since the Holy One, blessed be He, will not perform a sign or a wonder in every generation just to please some wicked man or atheist, He commanded us to recreate a constant memorial and sign of what our eyes had witnessed, and impart it to our children and their children, to their children until the last generation. That's something you hear a lot about, is if there's a God, how come we don't have miracles every day? How come, you know, we don't? How come no one's splitting a sea anymore? If the Torah is true, how come this never happens anymore? So one of his answers here is, God doesn't have any obligation to constantly perform miracles just so we feel better about ourselves and about God's existence, right? That's not God's obligation. The idea was that God did perform certain miracles at certain times for a certain purpose, and then it's our job to pass that down from one generation to the next so that it remains a reality, remains a cognizant reality. Leonard, you're ready.
That's what you consider a miracle.
You're right, so that's the other response, is all of life is a miracle, and it's very true.
I see miracles every day.
That's for sure. That's for sure. But
a baby
he's thinking
born, that's a miracle.
Yep, that's true.
But some would have an obligation, like Passover, let's say. You have a
right. Right. So he writes. So this
it
is right.
Would be nice to see the Red Sea split.
Right, but that right. And if that's the core of your religious experience, then you're in trouble, right? No, seriously. But if your core of your religious experience is about seeing specific miracles, right? You know, the Jesus painting crying or something. So then you're going to be in trouble. So what you have here is, so he writes is that you have different ways of commemorating something. You have the moment that it happens, right? So you have the big commemoration where you really embellish it, make a whole big deal out of it. And then you have the constant reminder that happens in smaller ways, but happens, you know, every single year. Or, I mean, every single day. So, I don't know, there's a lot of different examples you could give for this. Let's say you have July 4th, right? So July 4th is a day you commemorate and you remember what America is and how we got here and what it's supposed to symbolize and all of that. And, you know, every day, so as a kid, you know, I remember every day you get up, you look at the flag and you say the Pledge of Allegiance, and that will be your daily reminder of what this was, right? We don't, you know, do that as adults, of course.
Thanksgiving with the turkey.
Yeah, you have different times throughout the year when it'll be tied into other things. But that's the way we are, is that you can't spend all day every day talking about how great America is and what America's about, because then you wouldn't be doing anything but that. So you have to have, you know, annual times when it becomes at the forefront of your mind, and then you don't want that to be the only time you think about it, so that has to be a constant reminder. So he writes, that's what Tefillin is, and that's how Tefillin is connected to Passover, to Pesach, is that Pesach is the time when we really think about it, discuss it, and analyze it, and it becomes who we are. And then throughout the year, we have smaller things that we do. Saying the Shema does that, putting it on Tefillin. So that's supposed to be kind of a daily reminder, a smaller scale of that. All right, let me finish what I told Jonathan I wanted to talk about. I thought that was interesting. So, why do we put Tefillin on our weaker arm, on our left arm, if it's supposed to symbolize our strength? So the Kli Yakar says something interesting. So he says that the mind and the body typically work in opposite tandems, right? If you want to do a little graph here. For those of you listening at home, sorry, you can follow along. But you basically have them working at different points in time, right? When a person is young, their strength is the greatest, right? As Socrates said, youth is wasted on the young. So what does he mean? Is that they have all this energy and this strength, and it starts off up top, and slowly but surely throughout life, they get weaker and weaker physically. Intellectually, we work in the opposite realm. We start off with no intelligence, and we learn and we learn and we learn, and hopefully throughout life, if we do things right, we're constantly getting smarter and learning more and getting more wisdom and getting more experience and understanding more about life. So ultimately, our physical strength and our emotional strength are constantly working in opposite directions. As one is gaining, the other one is losing. So he writes that the weaker arm is supposed to symbolize that the brain is controlling the action instead of vice versa. Right? As we said before, it's going through the brain to the heart to the arm. So what he wants to say is that if done correctly, the action, right, the intelligence is ultimately what's winning out. Over time, you're growing in your intelligence, and that's controlling your actions more and more. So that's kind of the progress of life that you're going through. Your weaker arm symbolizes that your action, your pure strength, should be the least cognizant of your skills, right? We're almost downplaying your physical strength by putting it into your weaker arm, and then you would leave your stronger arm all by itself to symbolize that if your actions are left unchecked, and it's your action, it's your pure physical, your physicality, it becomes your focus, then your stronger hand is all by itself, it's naked, quote-unquote, then it's going to run free. So if you're able to sublimate your action, that's your weaker arm, showing that your action doesn't become your focus. That makes, I don't know if I explained it correctly. It took me like 5 times to read the Kli Yakar to think I think I got it right. I had to read like 4 or 5 times. Does that make sense, Jonathan?
Well, then maybe there's a practical reason too, in that it's hard to tie the correctly.
Oh, come on! Yeah.
No, it's a technical.
That's the best reason.
You're right. I hear it say, but come on.
That's the best explanation I've heard so far.
Oh, come on, Leonard. You can go to Jonathan's class on Thursday night.
That is the best explanation. But you know what?
You see the abuse I take in my own class?
The brain has a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere.
That's true. That's true.
And they control the opposite sides of the body.
Mm-hmm. And different things as well, right?
Does that have anything to do with this?
I don't know. You have something? I like it. Where are you going with it?
Let me try.
You're probing. It's a good. It's a good thing.
Could be. I mean, you could make an argument.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, comments? Okay, we will stop here. What is our next mitzvah? You know, I haven't even looked ahead what the next mitzvah that we're going to do. Because now we get into a lot of we get into a lot of narratives. Is there a mitzvah before the Torah is given? I'm not sure there is.
Pesach.
We did Pesach. We're going to start the mitzvah of the Ten Commandments then. Because I'm pretty sure that the mitzvah of Man didn't last. So.
Is it one mitzvah for the Ten Commandments?
What?
Is it one mitzvah for the Ten?
No, there's a number of mitzvot. So the next mitzvah we'll do is there a mitzvah to believe in God? That will be the next mitzvah. Is there a mitzvah to believe in God? Question on that, Avery.